Hello, and welcome to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. We are continuing with the last few days of reading Deborah Marquardt's The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, published by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group, in 2006. We rejoin this story as Deborah is talking about her visit with the state geologist of North Dakota in Bismarck. He is explaining to her the source of the unexpected water that welled up under her town. Then he traced his fingertip around the circle of pink on the map that marked the caverns of water under my hometown. It was not a river at all, he explained. Instead, it was a glacial outwash, a system of springs and cisterns and finger streams, a permeable honeycomb of stratified sand and gravel through which water can filter. More like a sponge than a river, he said. As indicated on the map, the underground glacial outwash spread miles around my hometown. But looking further, I was surprised to learn that the entire area that constitutes my family land is marked not as farmable till, but as a hydrologic feature, a massive above-ground lake. It's called Lake McKenna on the topographical maps, but we always called it Westlake. Only vestiges of it remain on the southern and western edges of town. North of town, across Highway 34, bordering my brother's farm, is another isolated remnant of the big lake shown on the map. This pond is mostly shallow and reed-filled, too boggy for swimming. But Dad used to clear it of snow with the front loader in the winter when the water froze over, and it was excellent for ice skating. At home, we just called it the lake, probably because it was too close and familiar to warrant a proper name when we spoke of it between us. In much the same way as Midwesterners refer to Minneapolis-St. Paul as the cities. Paris may be Paris, and Rome may be Rome, but Minneapolis-St. Paul will always be the cities. In addition to the small remnant of a lake on the edge of our farm, we had patches of open water moving along a direct northerly line on our property, a series of sloughs and springs that rose and fell depending on the season and weather. We always thought of them as independent anomalies, low pockets of standing water that refused to dry up in an otherwise productive wheat field. My father saw them as pure nuisance, wasted acreage. But now, on the geological map, I saw that they were all connected underground, and that our entire farm, above and below the ground, belonged truly to the world of water, and that it was just on loan to us. Years ago, my brother took a photograph using a special mirror filter on his new camera that created the illusion of the farmhouse surrounded by water. The house appears twice in the photo, first high and dry, perched on the hill, and second, as a shimmering reflection in the glassy surface of the watery pasture below. I always thought he'd created a trick lake because, landlocked as we were, he yearned for a real lake. But now I wondered if my brother had sensed all along the water coursing deep below our land, and if this photograph was a manifestation of his intuitions. Why didn't we learn these things in school? I asked the state geologist. Maybe we had been taught them and the specifics hadn't pierced my distracted teenage consciousness. If I had known that I was growing up in such an interesting place, I said, I think I would have loved home a little more. Did I mention that the geologist was a handsome man? Oh, he was handsome. He turned to look at me when I asked this question, and I think I saw his dark brown eyes mist over. I realized then that being a geologist must be lonely work. To fall in love with shale and sediment and topography. To spend your days unearthing the deepest layers of glacial history and hold it in trust for an oblivious and ungrateful society that lacks interest in anything below the slightest surface. Signs and wonders. People always remember Hansel and Gretel's lostness, how they dropped breadcrumbs to leave a trail through the forest as they walked, and how the birds ate the crumbs. But few people remember the earlier part of the story, Hansel's cunning, the first time their parents attempted to abandon them in the woods. That first night, when Hansel and Gretel overheard their parents' anxious conversation about the lack of food in the house and their plans to lead the children deep into the forest at first light, Gretel despaired, but Hansel made a plan. He waited for the household to fall asleep, then went outside and filled his pockets with white pebbles that glistened in the moonlight like silver coins. The next morning, when the children were led into the forest, Hansel dropped the shiny pebbles as he walked. As night fell in the middle of the forest, Hansel and Gretel waited for the moon to rise, then followed the shiny path back to their home. When the children surprised the parents the next morning by emerging from the woods unscathed, the father and stepmother acted relieved. But the second night, after the stepmother convinced the father to try it again, only this time taking the children deeper into the woods than they had ever been before, the stepmother proved her true wickedness by bolting the door before going to sleep. So Hansel was unable to go outside and refill his pockets with stones. The next morning, he dropped breadcrumbs, improvising with the only thing that was left to him. It's easy to get lost in thought about the cruelty of Hansel and Gretel's parents, especially the spinelessness of the father, who won't stand up to the stepmother and protect the children of his first wife. And one could wonder endlessly about why Hansel and Gretel would even want to return to this unfriendly home. But home is home, as the experts tell us, and no matter how bad it gets, we will yearn even for the rough familiar. Besides, Hansel and Gretel know something we don't, something alluded to beyond the borders of the told story. How happy they were before their mother died, before the events that precipitated the stepmother's arrival in their lives. They remember that first father, and they wait for his return. So, when we encounter Hansel and Gretel in the troubled middle of their tale, they're holding out hope, working backward, searching for an elusive trail of bread that will lead them back to some idea of home they vaguely recall. Perhaps it's true that, as Thomas Wolfe wrote, you can't go home again. Mostly because, as in Wolfe's case, after you write about the place you're from, people are waiting at the city gates with pitchforks and burning torches the next time you try to visit. But another reason you can't go home again is that the shape you made upon leaving does not match your shape upon return. Not even for a weekend is it comfortable to step through the ill-fitting hole that your exit created, and take up residence in your old life. But return you must, if only in imagination. For if it's true that you can't go home again, then it must be equally true that you can't not go home again. Your home ground has left an indelible imprint on you. It is the landscape you learn before you retreat inside the illusion of your own skin, Scott Russell Sanders wrote. You may love the place if you flourished there, or hate the place if you suffered there, But love it or hate it, you cannot shake free. Even if you move to the Antipodes, even if you become intimate with new landscapes, you still bear the impression of that first ground. A few years ago, just as I was finishing graduate school, I attended a conference on Great Plains history and culture where I met Mary Defender Wilson, a storyteller of Dakota Hidatsa heritage. In the hotel lobby, waiting for a cab, we struck up a conversation about the places where we were from. When I told her I was from a small North Dakota town east of the Missouri River, she quickly told me that this was also the place her ancestors had once called home. In fact, she said, some generations of her family were buried around there on a mound near a creek. Our conversation became more engaged as we tried to identify her family's burial place, to match it against where my family's land was and where my own dead were buried. She offered me descriptions, a series of hills, a rise in the path, a curving stream. I answered her with place names, Bryant Township, Logan County, Lake Isabel, Highway 3. We leaned in and laughed at our fumbling. Try though we might, we could not locate our common place. So effectively had my history overwritten the memory of her family's place on this land. We found the American West a curious place, alien and bare to our ears, Richard Manning wrote in Grassland. Because of this, we failed to allow it to tell us its story, to give us its name. Around the same time I finished graduate school, worrying about where I would go next, I had a dream in which I was driving across an unending countryside of unfenced, grassy hills, en route to a large flint monolith I could see in the far distance. As I was driving, a disembodied voice in the car commanded, "Turn around, you're on hallowed ground." I responded to the voice, cranking the wheel so quickly that the car began to roll and I was thrown from the car. When I woke up in the dream, I was lying on the ground, hugging the curve of one of the rolling tan hills. The grass was dry and prickly, the color of a bear cub's belly. When I finally stood up, I could see that I was indeed on hallowed ground. A line of demarcation started directly at my feet. From that point forward, for as far as it was possible to see, the ground was encrusted with flat stones like jewels in the rolling surface of the hills. I bent down to look at the rocks more closely, and I saw that they were about an inch thick, flat pieces of sandstone and marble and granite, carved into the intricate shapes of letters. The entire landscape before me was strewn with them. I understood in one flash, in the way it's possible to do in dreams, that this was my oeuvre, my entire body of work revealing itself to me, observable for only this moment in one glance, and that I would spend the rest of my life working this field, arranging these letters into words, sentences, paragraphs. I really began to cry then as I took in the enormity of the task. But what overwhelmed me even more was that many of the letters were carved into the shapes of alphabets I did not know, and some were carved into the shapes of alphabets not known to the modern world. Fortunately, at this moment I woke up, just as you're often roused from a falling dream right before you hit the pavement. When I woke up, I found I was actually crying. I didn't stop for some time. After that, I began to wonder if these hills actually existed in the physical world. If so, what was their geographic location? Every time I'd met someone from a place I'd never seen, North Carolina, Nova Scotia, Israel, I would say, "Do you, by any chance, have rolling hills that are tan and round as a bear cub's belly?" It sounded ridiculous, but I wanted to know. I had an idea that this place was seeking me. Then, one time, driving back to North Dakota on summer break, I decided to take the southern route home using the smaller highways rather than the interstate, cutting across the countryside. As I approached the moraine that runs by my hometown, I could see that all the rolling hillsides were encrusted with glacial debris. For miles and miles, they were embedded with flat stones that sparkled in the bright afternoon sun. "Meaningful work," my father once told me, "is something I should never hope for. There's work you'll do for free because you love it, and there's work you'll do to earn a living." Hard words for an 11-year-old to hear, but I had asked the question, did he enjoy being a farmer? We had just spent a day picking rocks, all seven of us laboring under the hot sun, digging our fingers in the earth to pull free the small boulders that had surfaced in our plowed fields since last year. We would huff and complain under the weight of the rocks, then ride home on the stone boat at the end of the day, our clothes and faces dusty, our fingernails caked with dirt from the fields. It was impossible work, but even I knew it was necessary. If we didn't clear the new rocks every year, they would break the plow disc during planting, or the combine at the most inopportune moment during harvest. But I was curious about this constant movement of rocks. As we pried and shoveled and clawed, I continued to ask, "Hadn't we cleared this field last year and the year before? Where was this endless supply of stones and boulders coming from?" These questions remained rhetorical, because no one in my family cared to entertain them in the hot afternoon sun. We busied ourselves with hauling the rocks to the grassy corner of the North Quarter, the spot chosen by my great-grandfather 80 years before. In this way, we followed patterns set in motion decades before we were born. How strange it seems to me now, an adult woman so far from that life on the farm, that the struggle I face each day when I approach my writing desk to bring to language the stories pushing up beneath my feet feels so much like the hard labor of unearthing those half-exposed rocks in my father's fields. And no matter how fiercely I struggled to evade my fate as a farmer's wife, becoming a writer instead, how strange it is to realize that writing, the act of arranging language in neat horizontal furrows, is a great deal like farming. Still, I am tempted to turn away from the work. I want to idle the tractor into the shed and turn off the engine. I want to drop a small boulder on my toe so that I can hobble home to bed in a good book. But curiosity keeps me at my desk. I slow down, turn to the larger questions. Where has this story been hiding? What forces drove it to the surface today? The memoirist Patricia Hampel calls this dwelling. I have come from people who have always been polite enough to feel that nothing has ever happened to them. They have worked, raised families, played cards, gone on fishing trips together, risen to grief and admirable bitterness, and then taken patiently the early death that robbed them of a brother, a son. They have not dwelt on things. I have dwelt, though. To make a metaphor is to make a fuss, Hampel wrote. I'm after junk. I want to make something out of what my family says is nothing. My father never approved of my life on the road. He worried about my safety, my interrupted education, my financial solvency. I suppose he worried about my ruined reputation. "No one will marry you," he'd say. A few years after I graduated, one of my first rock bands was invited to play for my high school's prom. The night before, we were booked to play another prom in Rosebud, South Dakota. Then we packed up our gear and drove through the night to get to Napoleon. We reached our farm just as my parents were getting up to milk the cows. We parked the tour bus beside our farmhouse and slept away the day. My mother made us pancakes when she came in from chores. She made us spaghetti in the afternoon when we rose from sleep. The prom turned out to be an extravaganza. Mirror balls, fluorescent streamers stretching the length of the auditorium. Strobe lights pulsed, cameras flashed, and balloons fell from the rafters as couples with big hair, tuxedos, and chiffon dresses walked down the aisle. We performed from the stage in our usual manner, steeped to the teeth in leather, large stacks of amplifiers piled behind us, a fog machine blowing a crazy haze, flash pots popping off around us, 120 decibels of metal screaming at 120 RPMs. But what I remember most from that night is the face of my father, lost somewhere in the sea of faces, that anonymous crowd of parents with cameras relegated to watch from behind the wall of streamers, the outer edge around the circumference of the prom. The view of my father's face that night remains clear to me, as if lit by a spotlight, and his expression was one of worry. Why did we have to play so loud? Was this really music? Did we ever comb our hair? And now it was certain, he was thinking, no one would ever marry me. I was singing when my father died. A Saturday, 9 years ago, I was in my living room with my guitar player rehearsing for a performance. "When will I see you again? A fire burns on your horizon," I was singing when I heard the phone ring. I did not pick up the phone. We had a gig that night and our entire repertoire to review. "When will I see you again? Just tip your hat so I know that we were friends." We finished practicing, and my second oldest sister called later, going down the list of people my mother hadn't yet reached to deliver the news. Our father had died 1 hour before. In all the confusion that followed, I forgot about my messages. When I checked the machine hours later, I heard 5 seconds of crackling silence, then the smallest whimper, my mother's voice, I've always assumed, followed by the receiver crashing into the cradle. My father was a confident singer with a good sense of pitch. His timbre was light and reedy. It was easy to pick him out in church. He was the guy with the loud voice 3 pews back, singing the crazy tenor parts. Even on the days when there were no altos or baritones in attendance at the early Mass, he held to his tenor part, sounding even more wildly out of context. "Praise God from whom all blessings flow," he'd intone, "a lone sheep crying in the wilderness." We would blush and hide our faces behind our chapel veils, but he would sing on. "We shall come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves." My father valued invention. The obvious bored him. A kiss on the cheek, any overt expression of love, made him blanch with embarrassment. And he could be curt. When talking with him on the phone, you had to be careful to get the important news out quickly, because he would exit a phone conversation when he deemed it finished. You might hear a small grunt, something like, yeah, or okay. Then the line would click, and the hum of the dial tone would follow. Dad? You'd be left holding the dead receiver. Dad? Dad? Right after my father's funeral, a family friend rushed up to me in the vestibule of the church. She was a pianist whose polka band had played wedding dances when I was growing up. Oh, my, she said when I turned to face her. I never noticed before how much you look like your dad. Where does family resemblance begin, I wonder? In the shape of the eyes? A gesture? A tone of the voice? Is it in the turn of a phrase? The timing of a joke? A certain way of using the hands? I know from all these things that I am my father's daughter. I had to tell you, the woman said, that your father was always so proud of you. Excuse me? Your dad, she said. He was always so proud that you stayed with your music. What? I said, my eyes beginning to water. Could she possibly be speaking of my father, Felix? The one who would say, before you're old enough to draw Social Security, you should consider getting a real job. Yes, she continued. He talked about you and your music all the time. Right there, in front of her, I started to cry then. Not for me, but for my father. I saw he had been a Janus figure all his life, with two contradictory faces. The one side, the parental face, felt compelled to turn itself to me and say, "Settle down. Stop all of this foolishness." The other face, the thwarted artist, hid itself from my view, but secretly rooted for me at every turn. Since my father died, I've been finding dimes on jogging trails, in corridors of hotels, several times at odd hours on the sidewalk leading to my office building at the university where I teach. I don't expect anyone to believe this. At last count, I've picked up 64 in the 9 years since my father's death. They collect on my writing table in two etched liqueur glasses. 8 more dimes ride on the dashboard of my car with my sunglasses. The lucky ones I found while traveling that never made it back to the liqueur glasses. 20 or so more dimes hide in my coats and suit jackets. I rediscover them when I reach into my pocket while teaching or singing. I've picked these up along the path and have neglected to deposit them in the glasses. About 12 dimes sit in a shot glass on the counter of my friend's apartment, because after he met me a few years ago, he started finding dimes. And now my niece and my mother have begun to find them. But how did it begin? Immediately after my father's funeral, the house was full of cousins, babies, old people, young people. I wondered who would dare to sit in his chair, a lazy boy so thoroughly his that it retained a small oil spot on the upholstery where he rested his head in the end when he was too sick to go out. And this is where we're going to stop for today. I think that the next time we read will find us at the end of this book, which is The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt, professor of English and director of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University in Ames. You can listen to this program, The Community Bookshelf, every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. For comments, contact khoiradio@gmail.com or call 515-292-2878. This is Mary Richards. Thanks for listening.